This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
And so, while the end of the world scenario will be rife with unimaginable horrors, the pre-end period is full of opportunities for profit.
It reminds us once again that we in North America live in the world's last bliss bubble.
Should we plan for a big drop in consumption to save the planet? Smart decline? From the 2009 Gaining Ground Summit in Vancouver, British Columbia, you are about to hear Dr. Bill Rees, co-inventor of the Ecological Footprint. The meeting theme was Resilient Cities, Urban Strategies for Transition Times. On the topic, Planning Down, What If Can Do, Can't, Bill Rees is introduced by conference moderator Ron Abbott.
It is a pleasure now to introduce one of Canada's most eminent environmental scientists, as well as one of Canada's most effective teachers. For the past 40 years, Bill Rees has carved out a niche at the University of British Columbia within the School of Community and Regional Planning, and I think part of Bill's legacy is in this room this week, because so many of the planners who are working hard to reshape Vancouver and other cities learned their craft in part under Bill's guidance and tutelage. Bill is, of course, also the co-developer of the Ecological Footprint. And he has a penetrating mind, a rigorous commitment to research, and the ability, I think, better than most, to take that research and intellect and couple it to applied policy in a way that should light the way ahead for all of us. Please join me in welcoming Professor Bill Rees.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. I'm going to also thank Gene. I have a particular reason for doing this, and it is that he gave me this title. And I said, what can you do with a title like that? What if can do can't? So I thought about it for a while, and what you're about to hear is what I've attempted to do with that title. Rob mentioned that I am a scientist, and I will speak to you as a scientist, particularly as an ecologist, which frees me from the burden of having to be practical for the time being. So I'm not oriented to design, I'm not oriented to a city building per se, but what I want to do is to talk about the groundwork, and I want to start at the end of my presentation in case I never get there. These are the main takeaway points. And Nola Kate made some reference to this. The first point is that perception is everything. Our perceptions determine how we act out in the world. Cities are an emergent phenomena. They just don't happen. They come out of how we think about ourselves in relation to nature. So the structure and function of cities reflects how we think about that relationship. And unfortunately, our techno-industrial culture is a society of dualistic reductionism. We think of humans as separate from nature, reduce everything down to tiny parts, and we never seem to be able to assemble these in our minds as we go forward. So in this context, modern cities have emerged from our way of thinking on the landscape as fractured, incomplete human ecosystems. They parasitize the ecosphere in their present structure. For sustainability, if we're serious about this, cities must become much more self-reliant, much more self-producing, self-organizing. They must be much more complete as ecosystems. And I begin to think, when I hear these words, of something that I'm calling an eco-centered regional city-state. Provinces, by the way, have long since become obsolete for reasons I'll get to toward the end. There are two elements of context here. One is the scientific. By the way, I'm going to show no models, so those of you who are skeptical about models, everything on the board here is going to be real data. So these are real data about the human population explosion and the explosion of the human enterprise. I could have extended the x-axis into the next room for 50,000 or 100,000 or even 1 million years. It would have been just as flat as the 2,000 years I'm showing you. And what you have to take from this is that the past eight generations of humans live in a completely anomalous, abnormal period of human history, a period of growth. In fact, it's only been two generations of people since the 1950s in which economic growth or any form of growth has actually been an instrument of public policy. So what we take to be the norm is actually the single most abnormal phase in the history of our species. And if I were looking at any other species, I would call this the plague phase of the species, exploitation of its environment, which inevitably leads to implosion. I haven't got time to spend on the implosion part. The second part of context, again, goes back to the human mind. And it has to do with the psychology that Nola Kate talked about. I'm going to read the text and I'll explain it. And so while the end of the world scenario will be rife with unimaginable horrors, the pre-end period is full of opportunities for profit. And that's exactly how we're approaching this issue. We have an intellectual understanding of the nature of our dilemma, but our response to it is to green business, to develop all sorts of ways to make additional money, to grow in a somewhat different way when we think the way that we do. So the can-do vision that Jean challenged me with, I think, is incorporated in the notion that we can grow differently using technology to move us forward in pretty much the same way as we have in the past without any substantial changes in our way of doing business. So there's a problem, but our response springs from our belief in human ingenuity and the incredible capacity of people to deal with crisis. It's always worked in the past. It will continue to work in the future. And perhaps the most ebullient expression of this is from the late Professor Julian Simon, who wrote many books with titles like The Ultimate Resource, referring to the human mind. Technology exists now to produce in inexhaustible quantities all the products made by nature. We have the technology to feed, clothe, and supply energy to an ever-growing population for the next 7 billion years. That should stir you in your hearts, because this is the essence of true optimism. And by the way, it's also paralytic, because if you believe this, then there's no need to do anything at all. Well, I want to suggest that this attitude, this techno-fix approach, the can-do attitude, has led us astray. Most approaches to climate change, global change in general, such as renewable energy, hybrid cars, green buildings, smart growth, new urbanism, green consumerism, a very long list, are delusional. They do not take into account the science in any significantly important transformative way. They assume we can maintain growth through greater material and energy efficiency. It's really the status quo by other technological means. Now, here is really the key to what I'm getting at here. What the science says is that we need an absolute reduction in energy and material throughput in our economy of about 80% by mid-century to avoid catastrophic climate change. So you can accept it or not. It's probably safer to accept it if it's even marginally true. I'm going to assume it is true for the sake of argument. So the bottom line is that whatever you're doing, if we need that 80% of reduction, if your solution, if where you are working, does not result in an absolute reduction in energy and material use in your community, in your building, or whatever, then you're not on track. You're not part of the solution. You're really contributing more to the problem. So I want to give you a few examples of what I'm getting on here. This is a recent edition of the Ford Escape hybrid vehicle. Note that they appropriate one of our most powerful green cultural symbols, Hermit the Frog. That's a really authoritative figure. But the point is that we pander to the, we all want to be good, you know, I want to be nice, so I'm going to buy this car instead of another car like the Toyota Echo, for example, which gets 50 miles to the gallon, but it's not green because it's not a hybrid. So here we have the appropriation of a cultural symbol in the sale of more goods that are frankly not a particularly good example of anything. And again, as Richard Ridders said, it just perpetuates the illusion that cities ought to be built around automobiles. And this is actually a fairly benign example. Try this one. This is the Chevy. I just scanned these from some recent magazines. This is the Tahoe a hybrid. This vehicle weighs 7,300 pounds. That's 3.3 metric tons. but it's a hybrid. And because it's a hybrid, and by the way, it gets the lowest gas mileage of any hybrid vehicle on the planet, but it's a hybrid, and so it merits the Green Car of the Year Award for 2008. Now, again, people run out and buy this sort of thing because it makes them feel good about contributing to the planet. The only way to think about that is everybody drove one of these 7,300-pound or 3.3 metric ton vehicles, would the Earth be a healthier place? Which gets lousy gas mileage, by the way. How could it get good mileage? It weighs more than the average elephant. So we're in cities. We live in buildings. We're all moving to green buildings, green architecture, green housing. So between 1950 and 2004, the average new house in North America went from about 900 or 1,000 square feet up to about 2,300 square feet, an increase of 135% over a half century period, during which the green rhetoric continually accelerated. Everything about them is bigger. We've gone from, you park your car in the lane to four-car garages now, not being uncommon in some of these homes. They all have industrial-scale appliances, 9-foot ceilings, and so on. Meanwhile, while the house size is more than doubling, we see a shrinkage of family size from 3.7 to 2.6 people. So that floor space per capita increases by 236% during the period of the loudest green rhetoric you can possibly imagine on the planet. But these houses, a tiny fraction of them, are about 25% more efficient per unit area as the 1950s house. So it's completely delusional to think we've made progress. These new large-scale so-called greenhouses haven't a fraction of the green associated with them as the primitive old 1950s 900 or 1,000 square foot houses. We're living in a complete fantasy land. And as I say, the way we think about things produces the products and the marketing and all the rest of it that is shaping the culture that is taking the planet down. Now, in that kind of context, cities could be resilient, but we've created them to be among the most vulnerable structures on the planet. I love this quote that I found. I don't even know where he said it, but Martin Oppenheimer, an American sociologist, today's city is the most vulnerable social structure ever conceived. They're threatened by peak oil, by soil losses, by climate change, by geopolitical instability. All of these things, of course, are tied together. I wish I had more time to explain to you why we're not even sensitive to this as yet, but I want to say that much of it has to do with the way we have conceived our cities. Cities are incomplete systems. They are not the human ecosystem. The idea of an eco-city in a way different from what I'm going to talk about doesn't make any real sense. So if you were to encapsulate Vancouver in a bell jar or New York or any modern city, it would suffocate and starve simultaneously because the productive zone producing everything needed to maintain or sustain the city is happening elsewhere. The city is the human equivalent of a livestock feedlot. It's where we gather large numbers of people, but the productive landscape sustaining it is, scattered all over the planet. Cities have become, by virtue of the way we think about ourselves as separate from nature, parasitic blobs on the landscape. Horrible language to use. Vancouver's a beautiful place to live, but it's by far from being sustainable. We've known about this, again, for decades, since the beginning of the environmental movement. Eugene Odom, one of the great American ecologists, defined cities as parasitic. They are planned and grow without any regard for the fact that they must process vast quantities of waste and consume huge quantities of resources. Now, there's another fundamental physical law called the second law of thermodynamics, which makes the second two of these statements absolutely true. We think of ourselves as producers. We want to increase the productivity of the economy, of labor economy, and all of that. But the simple biophysical reality is that every act of human production involves the consumption of a vastly larger quantity of energy and material. So all human economic production is mostly consumption. Cities produce the wealth of nations only by consuming a vast quantity of natural wealth produced elsewhere in the ecosphere far from the boundaries of the city themselves. And here's an example of the parasitic nature of the human ecosystem, or rather of our urban culture. This is from Edward Bertinsky's new book on oil. I was honored to have written an introductory chapter to this. When I saw this photograph, I was floored because it reminds me I used to work in the far north. You stick your arm out the window and it'll be covered by 190 mosquitoes within 30 seconds. So these are mosquitoes, great mechanical mosquitoes, sucking the blood from the earth and pumping it down to the city to where it's consumed in making a whole lot of other nasty things. So if you want to kind of image what I'm talking about here, just think of a number of pristine ecosystems, natural forests, grasslands, marine estuaries, coral reefs, or whatever. Now contemplate forest clear cuts, eroding farmlands, depleted fisheries, and marine dead zones. The only thing connecting those two images is human economic activity, because that's the way we think. We're not part of nature, so it doesn't matter what we do out there, it won't affect us over here. Well, this is what's going on in northern Alberta. This used to be boreal forest. Again, a take from Bertinsky's latest book. It looks like an oil spill in your driveway, but in the middle there, I've pointed out a huge warehouse. This is tens of thousands of hectares of utterly desecrated landscape to feed the insatiable appetite of the Ford Escapes and Chevy Tahoes in the cities far away, where this kind of thing is out of sight and out of mind. How much of nature do we actually appropriate in that way? And this is what we've done in the development of our my ecological footprint concept. It's simply a measure of the amount of productive landscape required by any population, an individual, a city, a nation, to produce what it consumes and to assimilate its wastes. You all have a footprint. And because there's a declining amount of productive biospace out there, your footprint is growing as the available supply is shrinking, and as populations increase, we're all competing with each other, whether you're conscious of it or not, for the available biospace. We compete very successfully because we have very high incomes, enabling us to buy in global markets everybody else's eco-footprints. So the average ecological requirements of a person in this room is somewhere on the order of 7 hectares, something like 17 or 20 acres in that range. The poorest of the poor live on a third of a hectare, just a little less than an acre. On Earth, there are 2 average hectares per capita. So each of us in this room requires 3 to 4 times an equitable share of the global biocapacity to sustain us in the style to which we are accustomed. And despite all of the greening of our economy, this number gets bigger year in and year out as our salaries increase and as technological gizmos fail because of something called the rebound effect. The principal biophysical impact of improvements in technological efficiency is to increase consumption. Counterintuitive, but there it is. Now, the problem is that many countries now, because their populations have such large footprints, live mostly on land and water productivity located outside of their own boundaries. Every country in Europe requires 2 or 3 times the size of its domestic biocapacity to sustain itself. What globalization does has enabled the wealthy countries to extend their footprints into the productive landscapes of other countries and into the global commons. Now, there's 2 evil effects of this. The first is it removes from consciousness our dependence on ecosystems, because we don't even see that we're dependent on our local ecosystems, because we're not. Secondly, since everybody's doing this, it's drawing down the natural capital assets and filling up the sinks all over the planet, so as we blissfully move forward in our consumer lifestyles, we're actually all rising simultaneously to a lowering global ceiling of the true limits to growth. So one planet living would be living within the productive capacity of Earth, and if we did that, we'd have to reduce our footprints to 2 hectares per capita from the current roughly 7. But we're not doing that. Population is increasing. Per capita consumption is increasing even faster. So there's an accelerating upslope in terms of overall demand. This is now in exceedance of carrying capacity, we estimate, by about 30% on a global basis, which means that we are beginning to deplete the natural capital, the productive fisheries, forests, soils that we need to sustain future consumption. Even as we're in this state of overshoot, the productivity of the landscape is declining, and hence we're eroding our future prospects.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. You are listening to Canadian scientist Dr. Bill Rees from the Gaining Ground Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada, October 21st, 2009. The co-inventor of the eco-footprint, Bill Rees, is now warning that humans are consuming the planet to death.
Thinking of this in an urban context, now using our methods, a group under the direction of Dr. Carl Folke at Stockholm University examined the 29 largest cities in the Baltic states of Europe. That's around the Baltic Sea. So if we just average the total land area and population of those things and look at all the resource and energy flows and tie these back to the landscape, it turns out that every square kilometer, that's that little tiny square on the left-hand side, of urbanized land requires 18 square kilometers of forest in continuous production to provide the wood, fiber, and paper. 50 square kilometers of arable land per square kilometer of urbanized land to produce food for those people. These are big fish eaters, so it takes 130 square kilometers of the most productive marine environment for every square kilometer of those cities. The blocks on the right refer to the land requirements for the assimilation of the waste throughput. Everything that goes into an economy comes out as waste that must be assimilated. And there are two different sets of assumptions here. The black is a very conservative set. The other is a bit wangy. But the point is, somewhere between 600 and 1,100 square kilometers of productive biocapacity of landscape and waterscape is needed for every single square kilometer of urbanized land in the Baltic states. And this is typical of large, high-income countries in Europe, North America, and Japan. Now, any sensible urban ecosystem would include within its purview the productive landscape needed to sustain the consumptive activity going on in the city. And until we move toward thinking of the city as an entire self-producing, self-reliant urban ecosystem that incorporates these productive landscapes, we're going nowhere. Our current way of developing cities ensures that we continue to deplete the very regions that sustain us because we don't even know they exist. They become invisible because of the globalization phenomena. Think of a city like Tokyo, which is a monstrosity. It's a wonderful place in many social and artistic and cultural, technological ways, but it's not supportable. Tokyo has 33 million people, the same population as Canada. Tokyo requires, to sustain itself, an area that is 4.3 times the area of Japan and about 2.1 times the nation's domestic biocapacity. Japan is very productive, but the bottom line is that Japan could not support its capital city on the entire biocapacity available to it were it cut off from global trade by climate change, international geopolitics, which may go rangy when we start competing for energy and resources, and so on. This is an unsustainable entity. And many other cities on the planet are following this path because of the assumption we can always have access to these resources wherever they are on the planet, as we exist in complete ignorance of the fact that we're depleting it even as we talk about this. So there are three major vulnerabilities to cities. The first is the erosion of agricultural landscape. Most cities couldn't come close to sustaining themselves if every bit of green area were planted to vegetable gardens or fruit trees. We need a much larger area than that. And right now we're losing agricultural land at an accelerating rate. We've lost enough in the last 30 or 40 years to feed all of Europe, for example, and the pace is increasing. Well, we don't notice because oil, in the form of fertilizers, pesticides, mechanized agriculture, have maintained productivity and increased it in areas, even as other areas are being taken out of production. The problem is, and this is our second vulnerability, the phenomenon of peak oil. Most of the major oil fields on the planet were discovered in the early 1960s. That's when the peak of discovery occurred. In the early 1980s, 20 years later, we passed the point at which every year consumption increases more rapidly than new discovery. And we've reached the point then where most people now who study this carefully think we've plateaued and are about to begin a long descent. And I don't care what you think about solar energy, wind power, or any of the available alternatives right now. I'm the guy who said we don't have the technologies ready to go forward. In total, they do not begin to replace the energy demand of society that is currently satisfied by fossil fuel, which is a real problem also because of the climate thing, which raises the third vulnerability of cities. The simple fact of the matter is that cities, our current agriculture, all of that depends on an extraordinarily stable period of climate during which the soils were formed and the agricultural development has occurred. If Canada warms up by 3 degrees and the agricultural climate moves north, it's going to move north into the tundra, the boreal forest. This is not good soil, and our best soils may not be capable of sustaining significant productivity. At any rate, carbon dioxide emissions, which are driving the human component of climate change, were by no means the major part of climate change, but were a major component at the margin. Carbon dioxide is the driver here, and carbon dioxide emissions are rising now much faster than the worst case scenario of the models. And I want to emphasize this. It's true that the climate change models are erroneous, but they're erroneous in the wrong direction. I could put up 100 slides to illustrate that. So we've seen increases since 2000, about 35% ahead of projections. This is what it looks like. Again, real data, not a model. This is from Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. The instrumentation is sensitive enough to catch the breathing of the Earth. The sawtooth pattern is the summer and winter oscillations. In the summer, plants are sucking up the carbon dioxide. In the winter, it accumulates. But every winter, a little more accumulates than was taken up in the previous summer. And so we have a steady increase. And notice that the increase is increasing from 1.3 parts per million in 1970 to 79 to 2.3 parts. It's doubled. The rate of increase in CO2 emissions or accumulations is doubling. And it has a corresponding impact on climate. Again, it's a jagged picture, but the trend is clear and upward. And notice in particular that between 1940 and 1980, it was actually seemingly cooling. So the fact that we're in a 2 or 3 year cooling period right now, not cooling, just slower rates of warming, doesn't mean it's over. It means that the climate is very erratic, and it will start ticking up again when certain circumstances, I haven't got time to describe to you, take hold. Now, here's the real kicker. The most recent studies, and this was just reaffirmed this week by the Hadley Center in the UK, suggest that we are going to have one hell of a time restraining carbon dioxide emissions below 650 parts per million. Note here that we're already approaching 400 parts per million. The safe level over on the far left is 300 parts per million. And now we're seeing signs that because of the unanticipated uptick in this, that we're unlikely to reconcile below 650 parts per million. 650 parts per million means about a 50% chance of a 4 degree or greater global warming. Now, that is an astronomical change in global climate. In order to avoid this, we need to begin reducing our emissions. Remember I said the only thing that counts is an absolute reduction, by about 6% per year and accelerating thereafter in the OECD countries. No country on Earth is coming close to policy that would even remotely approach this kind of target. So again, if the science is correct, we are condemning ourselves to a 4 degree world. And this is what a 4 degree world looks like. I mean, 4 degree warmer in mean global temperature. All of the yellow and brown areas are essentially uninhabitable landscape. And you'll notice that includes India, China, most of Africa, that's about 3 billion people right there, a good part of South America, and about half the United States. The only places that come out ahead in terms of temperature, at any rate, are Canada and Russia, and they will be asked to accommodate the 3 billion other people who can no longer live in their territory. So this is not just dicking around. You know, we're in a bliss bubble if you think that, you know, green lead whatever is going to make any difference at all. It's just growing us more efficiently. And there's no particular virtue in becoming more efficiently unsustainable. That's what this message is all about. So get ready for it, because we've had a shipload of people land on the coast here. That's just a little preview of what might be happening in 50 years when hundreds of millions of people are displaced from coastal communities, from agricultural lands that are abandoned because there's no water or the soil has otherwise been depleted, and so on. There are dozens of studies you never read about in the news that talk about these consequences. Here are quotes from two of them. The Age of Consequences: we predict an inevitable scenario in which people and nations are threatened by, etc. I won't read these. But the point is, why aren't we paying attention? These are high-powered, high-paid studies of the social consequences of global change. What we mean, or what this all boils down to, and again, keep in mind, I'm assuming the science is right, I'm assuming we want to survive, the only thing we need to think about is how do we reduce our absolute contribution drivers here. And again, it goes way back to an International Business Council on Sustainable Development meeting in Antwerp in 1993 that said, look, the data suggests, even then, that it's a 90% reduction in energy and material throughput in rich countries, because in order to create the ecological space, in my terminology, the eco-footprints of the rich countries have already appropriated most of the biocapacity of the planet to make room for those. The UN last week announced that officially now 1 billion people are in starvation, badly malnourished. That's the largest number ever in the history of the planet, and more people who were alive than were alive when Malthus wrote his original essay. That's the situation we're facing. And we aren't conscious of it because it's over there somewhere. But they say a 90% reduction. Our ecological footprint work says that if we're going to have sustainability with equity on a single planet that is shrinking, then we in North America should be working now to devise the social safety nets, the structural changes necessary to bring our per capita eco footprints down from an average of 9 in North America to about 2 per capita. Now, cities have a huge leg up in doing this. I'm a great fan of density. I was somewhat behind the eco-density movement in Vancouver here, advising the mayor with a group of my students on how we might conceive of that. I know some of you have difficulty with the equity aspects of it, but that can be taken care of. The point is, there's all kinds of economies of scale and agglomeration economies that emerge from higher density. These slides are freely available to anyone who wants them, so I'm not going to read this. But we need to go further. Efficiency is not enough. All the eco-density stuff is efficiency-oriented. We really need to rethink the city as the human ecosystem. We need to reconceive them and redesign them to incorporate as much of their supportive ecosystems within their own political jurisdictions as is possible. If you know that you are dependent on that acre, you will not permit unwarranted greenfield development on that acre. We are paving over the Fraser Valley despite the land reserves because we assume we can always import our food from elsewhere. The elsewhere is mostly California, which if you speak to people from California are now saying, we may not have any agriculture in 50 years at the rate the water is drying up. They've had to shut down tens of thousands of hectares this year because there is no water. We have a very, very limited view of our own sustainability if we continue to think we can continue to, in a sec, parasitize other places simply because we have the money to do so. So we have conceptual models, bioregionalism, learning to live more or less off the land base in your region, permaculture, which would double the productivity of our land base without having to resort to chemical pesticides and fertilizers and all of that sort of thing. So I'm thinking we really have to think 50 years ahead in terms of reconceiving the city as an urban-centered eco-city state. The provinces are obsolete. The Canadian Constitution makes no reference to communities, to cities. It's provinces in the federal government. But most of us now live in cities. Why not reorganize our settlements so that they are in charge of a significant resource base in their vicinity? Wouldn't work for a place like Tokyo. Tokyo needs other kinds of arrangements. But Canada, parts of the United States are capable of thinking this way. This is really going outside of the box so that we can claim this urban system as a complete self-referencing, self-producing, self-sustaining, self-supporting entity that is not dependent so much on other places. It doesn't mean no trade, because if we have a network of these kinds of interdependent regions, they can exchange, but they exchange in terms of true ecological surpluses. And that's where we should be going. And it's actually an old idea, going back to some of the great planners, Patrick Geddes, Lewis Mumford, Ebenezer Howard, and so on. Now, a lot of people say, God, that bugger's, you know, depressing. And listen, this is the good news, and I just want to take you through it. I'm saying the science looks good to me because it's just unfolding exactly as we've said it would all along. So if we stay the course, in other words, business as usual, we're going to get accelerated resource depletion, accelerating global change, climate chaos, greater systemic pollution, economic uncertainty. Hey, we've had a lot of great economic stuff, coming out of the mainstream recently. A widening income gap, which is steadily happening all over the planet, including in our own country. Increasing civil unrest, potential geopolitical chaos, and possible cultural collapse. Now, there's a really neat scenario for you, and it comes right out of doing nothing, which is what most of our politicians would like to have us do. On the other hand, if we take seriously the science and move toward an eco-transformation of sorts, we might get conservation and restoration of the essential natural capital we need to sustain ourselves, agricultural soils, forests, water supplies, and so on and so forth. We would have cleaner air, soil, and water. We would have a higher degree of economic security because we would plan social safety nets so that people who are being displaced from such sunset industries into more sustainable forms of development have that transition support from the rest of the community. We need to recreate community is a message that's coming across here, which means narrowing the income gap. We need greater social capital and sense of community, greater political or geopolitical stability. See, down this path on the left, we're going to be at war within 40 years over the declining resource base. It's already beginning to appear in such things as Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. So we need to move towards the right because the pressures are real, and we'll be better off for it. So again, this is the good news story. The political conundrum is the following. We can't muster the will to move toward eco-transformation. And it has to do with cognitive dissonance. Something else that Nola Kate mentioned. Human beings evolved such that as a person develops individually in a society, we take on the baggage of that society, the political ideologies, the ways of thinking, you know, the Cartesian dualism I spoke about at the middle. And it actually helps to shape synaptic circuitry in the brain. And once that's in place, it's very difficult to shift out of it. Nola Kate mentioned, we don't like change. Well, this is why we don't like change. It's, in a sense, hardwired by your individual development. And once it's hardwired, we seek out experiences that reinforce what we already think. That's why most of you are in this room, by the way. And we avoid, deny, or otherwise denigrate anything we don't want to hear about. And that's how we act. So we're always resistant to change because if it worked for my grandfather, it worked for me. And by the way, that was an adaptive strategy 3,000 years ago. If you survived in a tribal circumstance, it's because they were doing something right. Better to take on that burden. But now it doesn't work because the very circumstances that we have created comes from thinking that is destructive. And if we take on that thinking, we'll just carry on down this path. We really need to shift. The problem is what's ecologically necessary is politically unfeasible. But what's politically feasible, look at what we're doing in this country. We don't even have a climate policy, is ecologically irrelevant and will get us nowhere. So be the change, as someone has already said. And by the way, good luck. Thanks very much.
You have just heard a keynote presentation from the 2009 Gaining Ground Summit in Vancouver, British Columbia, held October 20th to 22nd. That was Dr. Bill Reese, co-inventor of the Ecological Footprint. The meeting theme was Resilient Cities, Urban Strategies for Transition Times. Bill Reese spoke on Planning Down, What If Can Do Can't. This recording is by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Find this and other speeches as free MP3 downloads in the Cities section of our audio on demand menu at ecoshock.org. For more information and video of the Resilient Cities Conference, go to www.gainingground.summit.com. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Find lots of free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. If you scroll down a bit on our main page, try out the Audio On Demand menu. The Resilient Cities Conference recordings are on our Cities page, of course. EcoShock.org is one of the net's largest free download sites for the environment. broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive. Bill Reese is normally a mild-mannered man. Recently, he told a Peak Oil crowd he'd rather be playing his oboe in a wind quartet than worrying about the future of the world. But Bill's a facts-are-facts kind of guy, and he's upset about our prospects. For example, let's explore a dialogue between Bill Reese and Warren Karlenzig, the California Green Cities guru, about China's green announcements. Karlenzig, whose Green a City blog tends to find the positive, has been exploring Chinese development. Is China headed toward new eco-cities or plunging into an environmental nightmare, or both? Karlenzig and Reese debated the future of China in a question-and-answer period recorded at the Post-Carbon Cities presentation October 20th in Vancouver. Warren Karlenzig begins to answer a question from the audience about their conflicting sense of China's ecological direction.
Well, the overshoot is absolutely there, and it is scary when you see the scale of overshoot. Dwarfs anything that we could comprehend. It's depressing, you know. But what gives me some optimism is that China is looking at these 40 new eco cities, and these are going to be major population centers. When China does things, it does it huge. They have the state planning agencies behind it. They have complete buy-in, and it's very different than zoning or planning in the United States. In most Asian countries, it's very different. So there is hope there that they are getting it, even more than the United States in some regards, the resiliency issue. But yes, the consumerism, the moving up the consumption ladder to emulate the United States, that's definitely there. They 3 years ago in Asia, a green city to them meant parks and open space. It was kind of like the 1970s conception in North America of what a green city was. And then I tried to, you know, bring concepts of land use planning, transit, you know, all these renewable energy, and that's part of it too. Oh, and now they understand that green buildings definitely part of it in a lot of the countries. They understand these other issues too, but the public doesn't, and that's a big issue there. So the media is completely different there. You know, they don't really publicize the green movement like they do in the United States. There's a big disconnect there. But China, I think, will change. They have to change, and they know it. They look at the long-term picture, in China in particular. They look at dynasties. They look at hundreds and thousands of years, and they're doing that now with energy, with the automobile, with water. I didn't mention the Tibetan Plateau is 40% reduced, and that's where the six major rivers of Asia all come from. So it's scary in many ways, but there is some hope.
I just want to build on the scary part and maybe the hope part. Part of the Beijing area is drying up. Beijing may have to move. Yeah. I'm serious. This is not, we're not joking around here.
Next year, it's going to be the water crisis of 2010 is going to hit the public consciousness in the international media. They're stealing water from outlying districts and communities or taking it, expropriating it, and bringing it into Beijing. It's a race, and they're trying to build a diversion canal from the south to the north, and it has no planned completion date. So they have enough water for 14 million people. Now there are, I think, 18 or 19 million people in the city.
And keep in mind, in China, if you move all that water to support the 14 million people in Beijing, you're taking it away from the 6 million people who live in the areas that you're drawing down to bring that water in. So China has inordinate problems. One half of all the new construction of buildings in the world today is taking place in China. And for the most part, now I totally agree there's a lot of planning for so-called eco-cities, but for the most part, Chinese construction is the least efficient and most concrete intensive on the planet. So one half of all new construction is taking place in China using concrete, which is enormously carbon intensive, and the buildings are not built to a high degree of efficiency or any other standard that we would accept for the most part. Moreover, most of that construction is residential, which has the highest density of concrete compared to warehousing and that sort of thing.
So the impact of Chinese construction in and of itself, even if it's green, is going to be inordinately huge. And if we were really sensible about our own future, we'd be doing everything we can to share with China the absolute top end of our design capabilities, our building capabilities, to make sure that this one half of all the world's new construction is built at the highest possible standard with the lowest possible carbon footprint. But unfortunately, we're not doing that. I've seen at least one major new so-called eco-city in China. It's a catastrophic mistake in many respects. They've got the housing for the workers over here, the work sites completely on the opposite side of the city over here, and the way to get between them is through, guess what, mostly automobiles. So we've got huge problems to deal with, even in China, even with a lot of the eco-thinking that's going on down. There's been some spectacular failures that we could talk about if we wanted to. Well, I'm sorry. I mean, you got to face it the way it is. Well, I'll give an example of a very famous one that isn't built yet. It's been stalled for a variety of reasons. It's called Dongtang. Have any of you heard of Dongtang? Well, all right. So it's a high density. It will be a new city. It will, because of the high density, it gets some of the economies of scale associated with large urban areas. But it's a suburb of Shanghai, and the only access to it is either by luxury boat, because every dwelling in Dongtang has a marina, or car. It's also located in a prime waterfowl area and covering agricultural land. So when I raise this with the developers, no worry, we're going to build greenhouses to replace the agricultural land. But we've studied greenhouses to the nth degree of the kind they're talking about. They use 14 times as much inputs per unit product as a field-grown vegetable in that kind of climate area. So it's not a substitute. They do have, you know, wind power and solar photovoltaics. But, you know, the jury's still out even on photovoltaics yet as to whether over the long term it's a net energy source for a whole variety of reasons. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do it for this application or for that application. But it does mean that if you're going to do it as a major source of energy for any extended period of time, you better be very careful about the circumstances in which you're putting it. So there's many reasons to be doubtful and optimistic about the Dongtang kind of development. But it's not going ahead at this point in any case. Another one, well, I already mentioned one that I saw. It was just a complete planning disaster. And it's fully constructed.
Yeah, Dongtang is not going to happen at all. There was corruption, and it's just not going to be built. It was ballyhooed around the world for a few years, and it's not happening. Tianjin looks to be the most likely first model of the new eco-city that they're going to build, and a district of Tianjin, and that's one of the 40 new eco-city districts I mentioned. Some of the metrics they have now for these districts, and these districts will be up to 500,000 people, are 90% walkability, bikeability, and public transit use. So 10% automobile use within these districts. They're going for 20% renewable energy, not very much at all. I mean, California is shooting for 30% by 2020. In fact, it's state law. California is going to have 30% all renewable energy by 2020. So they're all, you know, it's very minimal goal of renewable, so because they're so dependent on coal in China for power. There's not much in terms of local food. They are going to try to do some things with local food in Tianjin. The metrics are cloudy, though. They're very, you know. So those are the. That's what stands out to me. Green building principles. China is developing the 3-star standard. They're finalizing, or they're going to try to finalize that within the next year. It's their own green building standard. So it looks like there's going to be 3 international green building standards. There's going to be LEED, there's going to be China's 3-star, and then the European standard, BREEAM. That's where China is with their metrics right now. They need a lot of help there, but they're really willing to look at a lot of people's ideas right now. One firm, I can't mention who they are, they're developing a prototype of a city of like 20,000 people that could scale up to 1 million using renewable energy, geothermal energy, and they control the technology in this one area. It could be feasible. Greenhouses being heated with solar, thermal energy, not PV, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they've looked at algae as a fuel source, as an energy source, and as a waste. You know, it's a circular ecosystem in some ways. And the Chinese are interested in this company's or this outfit's approach. They're also looking at worldwide, there are cities being designed now that can withstand floods, especially in Indonesia. There's a city of 500,000 that might have to be rebuilt because it sits at the confluence of about 15 rivers and the water's rising. So the new vernacular for architecture for cities near the ocean is going to be a 5-meter lower level that's sort of expendable. And the Chinese are considering that with their coastal cities as well now. They're looking at everything, which to their credit is something that, you know, a country like the United States would say, oh, that's ridiculous, you know, that's silly and you're crazy. China is saying, well, yeah, I mean, this could happen, or we're building cities for 50 years. These are the inputs we need to look at. So there's a lot more to that.
I just have to add a couple of points here.
Yeah. Again, please make it quick, though, because we've got only 15 minutes.
Without taking anything away of what Warren said, every increment of growth in China is based on the idea of rising incomes. And it doesn't matter how they build the cities. Even if they're 50% more efficient than they would otherwise have been, it's on top of what's already out there, which is already too much. What the world needs is an 80% reduction in absolute terms in its material and energy throughput. And that's basically fossil fuel use. Growing more sustainably doesn't cut it. Lead is growth. It doesn't cut it. It's growing more sustainably. Getting more efficiently unsustainable doesn't cut it.
You've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We just heard from Bill Reese that more growth, even if you call it green growth or sustainable growth, is just more consumption of a planet already on its last legs of biological support. Bill's dialogue with Warren Karlenzig was recorded at a panel presented by the Post-Carbon Institute. From that same question and answer period, available on the Cities page at ecoshock.org, we hear Bill Reese tackle the question of pessimism, optimism, and realism when it comes to the fate of our world.
Sometimes people call me a pessimist. This is an important point, because I'm not a pessimist, I'm not an optimist. These are just states of mind that have nothing to do with reality. Okay, you can be as pessimistic as you like. It's not going to change anything if the world's on a golden course. Or you can be as optimistic as you like, and if you're a passenger on the Titanic, you're going to sink anyway. So we want to be realistic in sizing up our situation. And I do that by looking at the numbers. And as I guess Dan mentioned, I have been doing this for some 40 years. The numbers are not getting better. That's just the truth. I'm not trying to make a bad story of it or depress you. But if you don't realize they're getting worse, you don't have a chance to respond to the circumstances in which we are going to find ourselves. So realism simply means opening the opportunity to respond to the real world as it comes at us. And one of the things that's preventing you from finding out about reality is the way we've structured this world so that people who have long since overshot their carrying capacity and live in inherently unsustainable environments are blinded from that reality by the flows of goods and services from other places that they're drawing it down, and so on and so forth. This is not a scenario that is positive. What I'm saying to you is that what is depressing is the way the world is going, the status quo, the business as usual, which is driving these trends that I continue to measure, is a depressing scenario. And I'm trying to break through that and say, look, if we accept these data for what they say and act accordingly, we can pull it off by restructuring our cities in ways that will enable us to survive and to have a future in a sustainable, steady state with a degree of equity that makes life reasonably pleasant for those of us who survive these circumstances. That's optimism. It's not pessimism. That's the first point. The second point is, how many of you have learned or heard about the shipload of Sri Lankans who arrived on our shores in the last couple of days? It reminds us once again that we in North America live in the world's last bliss bubble. Every other place on the planet is overcrowded and deplete. And we only live the way we do because this vast, relatively empty continent, with apologies to the First Nations people,
was an inordinate resource warehouse that has sustained Europe and all of us in North America in a material style that has never before been seen on planet Earth. But as I said, we use up all the resources. We are dissipating it as fast as we possibly can without pausing for breath on the growth trajectory that we all think is the norm. So again, that's the truth. Wake up to it, because other people are beginning to see what we've got and want it in places that can't possibly get it. We have created a mythic model that cannot be sustained on this planet. If everyone lived the way we do, we'd need at least 3 and possibly 4 additional Earth-like planets to achieve that sustainably. It cannot happen on this single planet Earth. So we'd better change our ways and project a model to the other 6.5 billion people on this planet that could be sustained. And it's not the one that they're getting from us. We are not radiating the proper message. The bottom line is that if the climate change scenarios are correct, if peak oil is true, there will be, in the lifetimes of many of you in this room, hundreds of millions, if not billions, of refugees on this planet seeking out the best places to go. And they will come, whether we like it or not, by any means possible. And by the way, that includes Americans coming up here to get our energy and everything else that we need to sustain what's left of the United States. Because if the 3 and 4 degree warming scenario, which is now being commonly accepted, it's the most recent study out of Hadley just this week, takes place, then 1/2 of the United States is uninhabitable by the latter part of this century. And that means 200 million people looking for somewhere else to go. So people, this is not, a minor little shift in consciousness. This requires some really hard thinking about what the hell we're going to do in these kinds of circumstances. We create cities today whose basic form will be in place in 50 years. The city we have today, there's a few new buildings, but the form was set 50 years ago. So we need to think 50 years ahead about our urban form and how we're going to live and where the agricultural land is going to be to sustain whatever population it is, and so on and so forth. And oh, by the way, what about the 2 million other people who want to move into the neighborhood when India goes belly up or whatever? That's the nature of the game, if the science is correct. Nobody knows for sure, but it sure as hell is playing out the way we said it would 10, 15 years ago.
This concludes our special on the thoughts and warnings of Dr. Bill Rees, a longtime professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. In the 1990s, Rees and his student Matthias Wackernagel originated the idea of the ecological footprint. Rees continued his strident analysis of growth, world economic development, and environmental resources. In his latest work, he explains why the North American model of growth will destroy Earth's ecology unless it is cut back quickly. He says we need to reduce our consumption by 80%. Think about that. Bill Rees can bring out endless charts and discussion leading to this one idea. Our current model is unsustainable, perhaps deadly. Continued growth leads to a steep decline. We can blunder into that catastrophe or try to manage it. Smart decline. Remember those words. I'm Alex Smith. Visit our website for all our past programs, ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Thank you for opening your mind to the awful truth.
Well, I'm running. I'm trying to make 100, 99 and a half, it won't do. On the bright side,
all I'm running
trying to make 100, 99 and a half, it just won't do. So rough it up.